is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, what a day. There's a bunch of things that I want to get share with you, from new tax tricks that Walmart's doing to anti-swearing laws, to the TPP and Phyllis Schlafly, to the banksters bailing out. It's a weird one. What do they know that we don't? I'll tell you about that later. But I want to start, and Phyllis Schlafly joining us on the TPP. It's like we're getting all sides of this now. And thank you. But I want to start out by talking about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley and what's his name, Lincoln Chafee. Let me just say up front two things. One, because the next president will almost certainly select three or four new members for the Supreme Court, and because the Supreme Court, in my opinion, illegally, but still, has seized so much power for itself that it is now not only striking down laws made by Congress, but inventing laws that were never approved by Congress. In fact, are in violation of the will of Congress. Congress passed campaign finance reforms after the Nixon scandals, and in 1976, the Supreme Court struck them down in the Buckley versus Vallejo case, or struck down about half of them, by saying that, no, spending money on politics is protected by the First Amendment. It's not. But if the Supreme Court says it is, then that becomes the law of the land. Now, the Constitution doesn't say that, but the Supreme Court says that, and everybody accepts it. So I don't want to get into a big debate about the Supreme Court, but my point is that, well, let me start back at the beginning. I'm wandering far afield here. My point is that because the Supreme Court is so powerful and so important, this next election, we all have to not just get out and vote for the Democratic candidate, whether it's Hillary Clinton, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, whoever, but we have to do so in huge numbers. Because the Republican Party, I mean, the Koch brothers have now hooked up with Shelley Adelson, and you've got now three people who have a combined wealth of over $100 billion to make sure that a Republican is elected president. And you had a Supreme Court that has said, you guys can take as much money as you want and make him president. And they're talking about this being a $5 billion presidential election, $2.5 billion on each side. It could be twice that. So even if you don't like Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley or Hillary Clinton or Lincoln Chafee, if one of those people or anybody else becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party, it is vital that we work for that person and we get that person elected. Now, that said, I get it that a lot of people are very dissatisfied with Hillary Clinton. Some of them just don't like her husband. They don't like the NAFTA stuff. They don't like I didn't inhale the equivocation. I mean, Hillary's doing it right now on trade. Well, I want to see the trade agreement. Well, I'm sorry. You can't see the trade agreement until after Fast Track is passed. And she didn't say a word about Fast Track. So, it's already kind of begun. I don't like that. But I will still vote for her, because the Supreme Court is at stake. I mean, I could give you this list. This was posted over on DU back on the 10th. And I'm sorry, I don't have the name of the poster, because it printed out on the second page and it's all I kept. But the headline is, "No, I'm not ready for Hillary." And it's just a list of votes comparing Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Bernie voted against the Iraq War. Hillary Clinton voted for it. Bernie voted against bailing out Wall Street. Hillary Clinton voted for it. Bernie voted against the Patriot Act in 2001. Hillary Clinton voted for it. Bernie supported federal recognition of gay marriage before he became a presidential candidate. Hillary didn't. Bernie voted against the 2001 bankruptcy legislation that locks in student loans and all these other things. Hillary voted for it. Bernie supports clemency for Ed Snowden. Hillary does not. She thinks he's a criminal and he should be in jail. Bernie has introduced legislation to allow medical marijuana. Hillary Clinton has in the past opposed that. Bernie opposed bombing Syria. Hillary Clinton at least appears to have supported it, the administration she worked for anyway. Bernie supports bringing back Glass-Steagall to separate investment banks from savings banks, and Hillary Clinton opposes that, or has historically. Bernie opposed SOPA. Remember SOPA and PIPA, the Patriot Acts for the Internet? Hillary supported those. Bernie opposed those. Bernie opposed the NDAA, which gave the military the power to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens without trial. He voted against it. Hillary voted for it. Bernie voted against the 2006 legislation to create a border fence between the U.S. and Mexico. Hillary was in favor of it. Bernie opposes the death penalty. Hillary supports it. Okay, those are, there's clear differences between the two. And my personal preference is that in every single one of those cases, I fall on Bernie's side, not Hillary's. That said, though, here's what we have to understand. Because the Supreme Court is at stake, and a lot of other things. I mean, the damage that Republicans would do if we got a Republican president, privatizing Medicare and Medicaid, probably amping up the drug war rather than dialing it back, sucking up to big corporations. It's unimaginable the damage that could be done by a Republican. So people say, well, but we really need to be calling out Clinton on this stuff. Here's my concern. Conventional wisdom in politics, and you'll hear a lot of pundits pontificating about this, is that there are these people called swing voters who sometimes vote Democratic and sometimes vote Republican because their politics fall in the middle. It's a lie. There may be a few people who I would call actually low information voters, uninformed people or idiots who just, sometimes they vote Republican, sometimes they vote Democratic. But the vast majority of people are either soft Democrats or they're progressives. And people who identify as independents are too progressive for the Democratic Party. We had Mike Papantonio on the other day. He says, I'm not a Democrat. He's too progressive for the Democratic Party. They're too conservative for him. And similarly, on the Republican side, you've got a bunch of people who say, yes, I'm an independent. I'm a Tea Partier. I'm not a Republican. They're too conservative for the Republican Party. So if you want to win an election, it's not about the swing votes. That's stupid advice that John Kerry got and that Al Gore got from Bob Shrum and people like him. Go for the independents. Move to the middle. Right? That's stupid advice. Reagan didn't move to the middle. George W. Bush didn't move to the middle. Bill Clinton did not campaign in the middle. He campaigned on the far left. What you have to do is activate your base with great enthusiasm. And so in this next election, whether it's Hillary or Bernie or anybody else, we still have to get out there because there is no such thing as a swing voter. But there are base voters. And it's the base voters who very often don't even call themselves Democrats or Republicans who actually decide elections. And the Supreme Court is at stake. And that's huge. So no matter how you feel, and I'm very concerned that a lot of progressives are spending a lot of time beating up on Hillary Clinton, like going through the list that I just went through and then just raging about it, which I'm not going to do. I mean, we have to acknowledge there are these differences. But, wounding a candidate with the base, which is what talk radio talks to by and large, I think is a very dangerous business.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, you could call me a pragmatist or you could call me a cynic. I think I'm pragmatic. I don't think I'm cynical. I think I understand this process, and I never did before, frankly. Welcome back. Before I continue with my rant, let's pick up a couple of Free Speech TV calls. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts, watching Free Speech TV online. Hey, Michael, what's up?
I was watching online, and I'm using the phone because otherwise I get distorted. I want to raise a point that I've heard nowhere about the TPP,
okay,
which is benefits and enforcement, in particular, not so much enforcement of worker rights that Mark Pocan talked about, but enforcement of the main deal. So, for example, if you think of what would have, take the thing with the WTO that you just reported about, that we can't label our food with country of origin.
Right.
What happens if the United States says, well, thanks but no thanks. We don't regard the legitimacy of this agreement, of this ruling, so we're not going to honor it. The question is always, what are the sanctions? Same thing for the TPP. If you think about the intellectual property decision or some of the other things, so let's say, let me make this a little histrionic so you can see the point.
Sure.
Australia and Uruguay have disputed some smoking thing with Philip Morris.
Right. They want to label cigarette packages generically, and Philip Morris doesn't like that, and they're suing them.
Okay.
On
and
the
let's
WTO.
Say the WTO or whoever the agreement is. Let's say they rule against Australia and Uruguay, okay? And Australia and Uruguay says, thanks, but no thanks. And this is more about the TPP because there are probably punitive sanctions. And the question is, why in all these cases, why the countries don't say, thanks, but no thanks, we're not going to abide by your ruling.
Right.
So take something more serious like the Egyptian or the Philip Morris thing is a good case. Supposing what happened is that now the corporations hire Blackwater and they basically try to overthrow the government. Or if they don't try to overthrow the government and it's a company, they seize the assets. We don't know, in short, what the sanctions are if you break the rules.
What we do know, Michael, is that they're monetary rather than criminal, which is why the pro-TPP trade agreement people are saying, this isn't law, you know, this is just rules, you know. But here's the deal. In answer to your rhetorical question, or your serious question, you know, why can't countries just say, screw it, we're out of here? It's because they signed a contract. And that contract is enforceable. And what they have to do is unsign the contract. In other words, they would have to have their national legislature say, we are withdrawing from the World Trade Organization. And there are massive penalties associated with withdrawing, by the way. So it's going to cost a fortune for these countries, far more than Philip Morris is going to extract from them, to get out of what they've gotten into. These corporate lawyers are really slick, Michael.
Yeah, I understand that. So what has to be spelled out with any agreement of this type is what happens, what exactly are the penalties for refusing to abide by a
right, and that's already in the agreements, and those penalties are draconian. And this is the problem that the same problem when Greece joined the Eurozone and the European Union, but principally the Eurozone, you know, started using the euro. You dropped the drachma. I had a member of the Syriza party, a member of the cabinet, the president's cabinet, on my TV show last night, and he was saying, you know, the penalties of bailing out, or what they call a Grexit, Greek exit from the EU, are horrible. I mean, it's just massive penalties. Michael, I got to run. Thank you for the call. Okay, so anyhow, I wanted to go through that. You know, this whole myth of the swing voter. There ain't no such thing. What there is the base voter, and that's what is consequential. And that is something that the Republicans have understood since Reagan. And the Democrats, particularly these Democratic advisors, the Bob Shrums of the world, have gotten completely wrong. Now, I think that the David Axelrod may understand that. I think that the Obama campaign was all about the base. And to a certain extent, he had a slightly larger base and a little more built-in base in as much as he had the African-American vote, or, you know, relatively predictably, since he was, you know, this historic first African-American president. Hillary may have the female vote, or a large chunk of it, because she would be the first woman president. And I think that would be a marvelous thing. But it's about the base. And so, you know, I know I will have guests and callers, there's no doubt in my mind, you know, between now, it's going to be a year and a half, you know, between now and the election, who are going to go off the rails on Hillary and criticize her for this, that, and the other thing. But I'm not going to. And I would strongly recommend to you, you know, in your conversations with others, that you not either. Because if we, what happens, what the Republicans want to have happen is they want us to be so upset about Hillary. Oh, here's the 45 times that Hillary, you know, supported the TPP. Right? Well, yeah, it's true in the past. And she's waffling now, in my opinion. And they want us to get all upset about that so that when the election comes, we won't show up and vote. This has nothing to do with swing voters. So just so you understand my thinking and my perspective on this. Okay, a few other things that I wanted to share with you. Speaking of the TPP, Phyllis Schlafly just published a piece. Our friend Phyllis, right? She's been on the program a number of times. She and I agree on the Supreme Court, but not much else. On Friday, she writes, Congress disrupted President Obama's plan for a sweeping transfer of U.S. sovereignty to an unaccountable group of foreign busybodies. Hooray for the stalwart Americans who resisted the demands of Obama, the Republican leadership, and the big donor clique. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would turn over to globalists the power to issue regulations about U.S. trade, immigration, the environment, labor, and commerce. It's also called a living agreement, which means that the globalists can amend and change the text of the so-called agreement after it has gone into effect. She writes, the secrecy raptor on TPP is appallingly un-American. Whatever happened to Obama's promise of transparency? I agree with Phyllis Schlafly. And increasingly, we're seeing people, the base, the Republican base, is joining the Democratic base in saying this thing stinks. Gaius Publius wrote a great piece on Monday this week over at Down with Tyranny. And tip of the hat to him for putting a clip of our program on with my conversation with Bruce Fine, who's a Republican, who's the Undersecretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, sat right here and said, you know, TPP is unconstitutional. Article 3 of the Constitution says, and I quote, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, under the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. In other words, any dispute should be handled by our court system. It goes on to say, and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens, or subjects. And it goes on from there. You know, trials of all crimes except in cases of impeachment shall be by jury, and such trials should be held in the state. You know, it goes on and on. Now, this ISDS, Investor State Dispute Settlement, these are trials. The World Trade Organization just held a trial about whether or not it was legal for the United States to require country of origin labeling on meat. And in that trial, they ruled against us, against the United States of America. And so Congress last week, in order to avoid paying massive fines to these countries that were suing us through the World Trade Organization, Congress last week repealed our country of origin labeling, which so many of us had fought for years and years and years to get. So, I mean, there's some really nasty stuff here in this TPP, and it's really important, I think, to be calling your member of Congress, 202-225-3121. Call your member of Congress and say, no to fast track, because that's what they're trying to push through now so that they can get to the TPP. No to fast track. Very simple. Here's another story. This was in today's Financial Times. I tell you, I read the Financial Times every day because it's the rich people talking to the rich people, right? The banksters talking to the banksters. Tom Braithwaite in New York, the headline is, Top U.S. Bank Executives Abandon Share Sale Taboo. He says, it was called the Blood Oath. The management team of Sandy Weill, an architect of the modern Citigroup and mentor to Jamie Dimon, had to commit not to sell any shares until they left. In other words, they owned stock in the company because they were compensated with stock, but they couldn't sell it until they left their job. In the decades in their partnerships, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley bankers had no need to open their veins, holding equity until retirement was a binding legal restraint. Well, that has gone away. And as they note, a Financial Times analysis of insider selling at the six biggest U.S. banks since the 2008 crisis shows that many of the current crop of executives have offloaded millions of dollars worth of stock every year. Number one is Mike Sherwood. He's the head of the London-based Goldman Sachs International Division. He offloaded more than $50 million worth of shares. Executives at Bank of America, Citi, Goldman, JPMorgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo. $38 million from the John Stump, the CEO of Wells Fargo.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So the question that is not actually raised by this article, but is raised in my mind, is why are the banksters selling off their shares in their own banks? What do they know that we don't? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Neil Young. Did you see Donald Trump's speech yesterday announcing his candidacy? I mean, you know, there's a bunch of put-together funny clips, and Stephen Colbert did a hysterical imitation, a six-minute imitation of it, which you can probably quite easily find on the Internet. It's a promotion for his, I guess it's in about 2.5 months, isn't it, that he's going to take over the Tonight Show? Or I don't know when it is. And it's not the Tonight Show, it's the Late Show, right? The Letterman's Late Show, yeah, on CBS. I'm never awake that late, so I haven't watched one of those shows in decades. But in any case, when Donald Trump came out and did his rambling 45-minute long stream of consciousness screed, which he is so good at, he's a very, very effective narcissist, you know? He came out to the music of Neil Young's Rockin' in the Free World song. And so somebody tweeted out, does Neil Young support Trump? And a spokesman for Neil Young said, and this is the official statement from Neil Young, quote, Donald Trump's use of Rocking in the Free World was not authorized. Mr. Young is a longtime supporter of Bernie Sanders. Ba-rum-bump. So there you go. Okay, so what do the banksters know that we don't know? I'll get into this swearing thing in a little bit. My take on it is a little more complex than we can do in just a couple of seconds. And I see we've got, you know, a bunch of people calling in and want to get on. So, Brian in Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm so excited. I heard Donald Trump speak. It's the first time I've ever heard anybody tell stuff the way it should be told. He's the only one that's sticking up for the blue collar worker. China's been ripping us off like crazy, and nobody's ever said nothing. All the Democrats are all for letting millions of illegals in the country, millions of people on visas. They don't stick up for the blue-collar worker. Clinton deregulated the banks. That caused everybody to go broke. I can't believe anybody would even think of voting for her. I'm so excited that Donald Trump is running.
Okay, Brian, I got it. And I'm excited that he's running, too. I don't disagree that Donald Trump is actually saying populist stuff. I mean, here's what's going on. On the left, the populist is Bernie Sanders. He's talking about what the average man on the street is concerned about. On the right, the populist right now looks like it's Donald Trump. And that's going to make a lot of Republicans very uncomfortable, particularly if he makes it into the debates. One of the biggest lessons, I mentioned this yesterday, I'll probably mention it, you know, many times again, but it was really surprising to me. When I first moved to Washington, D.C. 5 years ago and started doing the show from here, as we started it in Vermont, and then we moved to Portland, Oregon, and we did it there for 5 years, and then we moved here. We did it for 3 years in Vermont. When I moved here, I remember a couple of several different people, you know, by way of kind of welcoming me, people who had been on my show in the past. I'm talking about members of Congress, members of the media, whose names you would recognize, invited me to dinner parties at their homes here in Washington, D.C., invited Louise and I over, and with some really rather startlingly high profile guests, people who you would immediately recognize from television or politicians whose names you'd know. And would ask me questions about my position on issues and just try to, and at the time I was trying to figure out what they were trying to figure out about me. And after the first month or so after we moved here, all those invitations just evaporated. I haven't been invited to any of the parties. I haven't been invited to any of the events, period. And I'm not complaining about that. I frankly would probably turn them down anyway. But my point is that what I discovered from that experience is it's not Democrats versus Republicans. This is apropos of the caller who was just calling in support of Donald Trump. It's insiders versus outsiders. And the questions that those folks were asking me at those early dinner parties that I was invited to by members of the media, I'm talking about media TV stars, and by members of Congress, and I'm talking about, you know, Democrats. The real question they were asking me is, are you an insider or an outsider? Now that I look back on it in retrospect, it took me a year to figure this out, of living in this town. Because I figured you could move back and forth between inside and outside. You can't. Once you're labeled an outsider, you're out. Once you're labeled an insider, you're in. This is the problem. I believe that Jen Kuger, and I've never had a conversation with him about this, so, you know, he may disagree with me, but had when he was at MSNBC. He kept going off on issues that didn't please the insiders. And network television is all about insiders. You very rarely ever see outsiders. Bernie Sanders is the outsider on the left. Donald Trump is the outsider on the right. And I think that this election that's coming up is going to be about the insiders versus the outsiders. I think that what's going on is that the people of America, and I think this is what animated the Tea Party movement, you know, aside from the millions of dollars from the Koch brothers, who themselves were outsiders until just very recently, and now they've done basically a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. Now the insiders are coming to them on bended knee and kissing their rings. Right, so they've become the rulers of the insiders. But they used to be the outsiders. And you know, I don't have the kind of money or power to bend people to my will. But I'm telling you, that's what it's about. And I have a very strong feeling. This, you know, every 80 years we reboot this country. 80 years ago it was FDR. 80 years before that it was Abraham Lincoln. 80 years before that it was the American Revolution. I think this is going to be an election in which the base on both sides is going to, depending on the candidates, is going to turn out in big numbers and vote for outsiders, which is why I think that Bernie Sanders actually has a chance to win not just the nomination, the Democratic nomination, but win the White House. I mean, I've seen this. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. Republicans love Bernie Sanders in Vermont. He 73 or 74% of the vote. He won in the last election against a very well-funded Republican who threw $5 million into the, which is huge in a state with only 600,000 people, buying all kinds of television ads. Bernie did not run one single television ad. The press didn't like him. The press doesn't like him. He's an outsider. He doesn't throw money at them. So anyway. Enough of my rant. Charles in Conway, South Carolina. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Yeah. Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
I would like to know, with all these PT or TPP supporters talk about what we're going to export. What are we going to export? We don't make anything anymore.
Right. You're absolutely right. Actually, we do. We make weapons. We're the number one exporter of weapons in the world. And it's a very significant part of our export trade. And we export raw materials. When Ronald Reagan came into office, the United States was the largest creditor in the world. In other words, more countries owed us money than we owed them, than any other country in the world. We were the largest creditor in the world. And we were the largest exporter of finished goods and the world's largest importer of raw materials. So we literally imported the raw materials to make steel, and we exported cars and washing machines and television sets and all kinds of stuff. 35 years later, 35 years of Reaganomics and free trade craziness, and the Democrats play a relatively small role. Now, keep in mind, only 30 Democrats voted with Bill Clinton for NAFTA, and half of them lost their seats in the next election. But so this is mostly a Republican issue, even though Bill Clinton gets, you know, tarred with it. But the fact of the matter is that now, instead of being the world's largest importer of raw materials and exporter of finished goods, we have become the world's largest importer of finished goods an exporter of raw materials. So we're shipping, we're cutting trees in the Pacific Northwest, which is one of the reasons why Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell voted for TPP or for the fast track and TPP thing, because it would increase exports from Washington State, and it's why Ron Wyden supports it. Oregon, you know, it's so we're exporting raw materials. We export, we cut trees in the Pacific Northwest. We ship them to China. China makes them into paper and cardboard and uses them to package the products that they make and ships it back to the United States as finished goods. China has replaced the United States as the world's largest importer of raw materials, the world's largest exporter of finished goods. And we are no longer the world's largest creditor. We are now, with the $500 billion trade deficit, we are now the world's largest debtor. This is what 35 years of Reaganomics and free trade, you know, which arguably is Nixonomics. Nixon started this whole thing with permanent normal trade relations and with fast track. We've basically swapped places with China. We're on this downward decline. And Donald Trump was absolutely right about that yesterday. And he said, you know, you come into our airports and you know, I've traveled all over the world. Our airports are embarrassing. Amtrak is embarrassing. You travel on the trains in Asia, you travel on the trains in Europe. Charles, thank you for the call. And you can walk, you can sit a glass of wine on the table in front of you and not worry that it's going to go flying. You can't do that on Amtrak. Right? Because our infrastructure has, since the Reagan era, when Reagan stopped basically all investment in American infrastructure, we are falling apart. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you see, on the Democratic side, Donald Trump will say that on the Republican side. You know who's going to say that on the Democratic side? Bernie Sanders. Welcome back. Jim in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Jim? I'm not hearing Jim. He's on line 9, FYI. John in Birchwood, Wisconsin. John, thank you for watching Free Speech TV. Can you hear me?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I have a real issue with the Supreme Court justices hobnobbing with the rich and corporate executives, especially when they have laws to pass that pertain to their type of business or whatever they're in. And
sure.
Also, Tom, the fact about, you mentioned the TPP is against our Constitution, really so is a Patriot Act and this, you know,
yes,
following Americans without cause and warrant. I mean, the Constitution just seems to be something they use when it's going to benefit them and no other time.
You're absolutely right. The Patriot Act violates the Fourth Amendment, you know, 16 ways to Sunday, and the TPP violates the entire Article 3 of the Constitution. And yet the people who are promoting these things, the Patriot Act and TPP, would be the very, very first to say, we're doing constitutional work. You know, I'm not even sure they'd say that, but you know, and the Supreme Court justices refusing to hold to the Federal Code of Judicial Ethics, and instead, like you said, I believe it was Scalia and Thomas. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. Who were at several of these Koch brother events and they give, you know, paid speaking gigs and things. And Clarence Thomas's wife has taken over $800,000 from the Heritage Foundation, you know, which was, you know, again, you know, founded by billionaire right wingers. We've got a serious problem with this stuff, a serious problem. John, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Jim in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
My big thing is the Latino community. I feel that in 2016, that's going to be a big voting block that the Democratic Party will really need.
And that's why the Republicans are all excited about Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, because Bush is married to a woman who is a citizen of Mexico and has Hispanic kids, basically, or biracial kids, but whatever you want to call it. And Marco Rubio is Cuban. So,
but my big take on this, though, is that I've heard a lot of young Latino activists get out there, and they always put the onus on the president. And the onus should be on the Latino community itself. 2014, they did not get out and vote, and I feel they sent immigration reform possibly 5 to 10 years backwards.
Yeah.
They got to get out and vote. And this is something I think Bernie should really get out there and talk to him about, saying, hey, we need your vote. We got to get out there. If you want immigration reform, it's something that you're going to have to provide us with. The president can only go so far, and without your help and without giving me the House and the Senate, it may never happen.
Yeah. Now this election, and that's why I'm saying, you know, we can't be doing circular firing squad on our own people. Number one, this is and Ronald Reagan understood this, right? It was his 11th commandment: "Thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican." And we need to, you know, if we want to be as successful as Reagan in taking power and using power, that's where you start. Reagan and his campaign got it. They absolutely understood it. And when George Herbert Walker Bush, in the primary against Ronald Reagan, called Reaganomics voodoo economics, that was like a breach, right? You don't criticize other Republicans. So, you know, we'll see. But the congressional elections are incredibly vital. And, yes, the Hispanic community is going to be a big part of it. And we'll see where this all goes. Jim, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ed in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's good to have you in D.C.
Thank you.
Back to trade. I've been looking at the results of the trade balance change with South Korea since Obama got his South Korea free trade agreement passed during his first term. So it's been 3-4 years. It's the opposite of what was promised. Just in those 3 years so far, the trade deficit with South Korea has gone up by 83%. It's one of those hockey stick kind of graphs.
Yep.
And they were promising, both him and Clinton and all the others were promising $11 billion growth in U.S. exports to South Korea. They were saying all the same talking points we hear now with TPP about opening foreign markets to U.S. goods and creating jobs. The opposite happened. Instead of $11 billion increase, we have a net import of $12 billion.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Ed. And it's not. And you can do the. You can do that same math with NAFTA. You can do that same math with the Colombian South Free Trade Agreement. You can do that same math with the Peruvian Free Trade Agreement. I mean, there's been a bunch of them, and every single one of them has always turned out with the United States being screwed. And yet, this morning, as I was waking up, I'm listening to NPR doing a very, very long softball interview with, I'm pretty sure it was Paul Ryan. I didn't hear the intro to it, but it certainly sounded like Paul Ryan telling us how important it is that we do this and we've got to increase exports and this is where our jobs are going to come from. And, you know, because Paul Ryan's kind of the point guy in the House for this deal. But you're absolutely right. These trade deals always end up, you know, all the way back to Nixon, and which is why Bernie Sanders has opposed every single one of them publicly for 35 years, as have I. Ed, thank you for the call. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Well, I got a serious point to make, but a serious question, but also a kind of tongue-in-cheek observation. First, the wingnuts keep saying that, you know, 9/11 was because of don't ask, don't tell, the California earthquakes are because of gay marriage. Are the floods in Texas because God's mad at them for sending idiots to Congress?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, Thor or Odin. I'm not sure which one of the gods is mad, but probably be Thor, right? Wasn't he the one with the anvil and, you know, which made the lightning?
Yeah, very possibly. But seriously, on TPP, in the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Yeah, I think that was an Einstein quote, in fact, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah. And that's the American people have figured this out, and the Obama White House has not, or at least Michael Froman, the trade negotiator, has you know hyped this thing to President Obama in ways that, and to a few Democrats, tragically. But yeah, you would think that we'd figure it out. Chris, thank you for the call, Deidre. In Antioch, California. Hey, Deidre, what's up? Or Deirdre,
excuse me. I would love to get in on this subject, but I'm not going to because everyone else is doing such a great job. But the one thing that I keep thinking about is I love the way Bernie Sanders is talking about free college.
Yeah.
And I've complained about that for years. It used to be that if you had a good high school education, you could go out and get a great job. That's what you needed.
Yep.
Now it's we have to go beyond high school to college. But my issue is I really think we need to readdress grammar school and high school, and I think we need to change the way we fund our schools, because until we do that, until we put it in as part of the infrastructure so that all schools are built to the same quality,
yep.
all teachers, we need to educate all of our children.
I absolutely agree with you, Deirdre.
Regardless of how much their parents make or what state that they're in.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would like to do with education, because I'm so angry at the defense budget, I think we should tie them together. Instead of treating our education like the poor stepchildren, we say, okay, if you think you need that much money for the war or for defense, fine, but you have to give the same amount of money to education.
Yeah.
Everything needs to be tied into education.
I think that's a brilliant idea. I don't disagree at all. Yesterday, I had to run home very quickly. These electrical problems we're having with the boat. And I took an Uber car. And the woman who was driving me, as we were getting close down to the waterfront, we passed an old public school that is now a charter school. D.C. has more charter schools than any state. It's this is ground zero for the charter school experiment put into place by Republicans back during the George W. Bush administration in large part. And she said, oh, look, that's so-and-so charter school. It used to be such-and-such public school. And I was like, yeah, I'm not a fan of charter schools. How about you? You know, because she lives here in the district, the Uber driver. She said, I used to be a public school teacher. Now I'm driving an Uber car. She said, you know, I could tell you a story. She said, the charter schools do not produce better results. They do produce profits for the people who own them, but they do not produce better results. And the teachers, you know, lose a decent job, and teachers should have a decent job. So I think we need to absolutely do that. And it's tragic that we even have Democrats, you know, this is the Rahm Emanuels, the Arne Duncans of the world, who are out there pushing more charter schools. We need to reinvigorate our public schools.
Changing the way we fund our schools.
Yeah.
I just never hear this come up.
Yeah, and take it out of the property tax and move it into some more general fund so that a public school in rural Louisiana is just as good as a public school in downtown Boston.
Just say, hey, if I like their school, I want you to build me one of the same quality.
Right.
I want the same quality teachers.
Right.
To me, education is the absolute backbone of democracy. You cannot have a democracy without it.
That's what Thomas Jefferson said.
It's eating around the edges. I think we need to get back down to education, education, education.
Yes. I absolutely agree with you. Jefferson said, you know, without an educated, I'm paraphrasing, but you cannot have a functioning democracy or a functioning republic without an educated electorate. And I'm totally with you. From pre-K. Now, Hillary Clinton just came out and called for universal pre-K. That's wonderful. That's a great start, step by step. You know, like I said, I don't agree with Hillary on everything, but boy, compare her to a Republican, and I am all over Hillary Clinton. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our friend Neil McCabe is on the line with us. He is now the political director with Gravis Insights, a Florida-based pollster, and he's still a columnist for the conservative townhall.com. Gravisinsights.com is Neil's new website. Neil, welcome back.
Hey, great to be with you, Tom.
Thanks.
I don't know why you have to say conservative for townhall.com. You can say right-thinking.
Or right-wing.
Oh, wow. That's kind of hurtful.
How about Reich thinking?
Wow.
See.
All right, let's talk about something else.
Yeah, let's start over again. All right. So I'm looking over on Crooks and Liars and .com, and the top story is, it's got a picture of Bill O'Reilly interviewing Donald Trump, and it says, O'Reilly to Trump, you're going to slash and burn at the debates. And I was going off on this earlier, and you, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, actually, Neil. I was talking about how when I first moved to this town, I was invited to a bunch of cocktail parties, and some of them specifically around me, you know, hey, come meet Tom Hartman kind of thing, by both members of Congress and members of the media. And then that kind of all went away after about a month because people figured out that I was not an insider. I was an outsider. And that it's not about left or right in this town. It's about insider versus outsider. And Donald Trump is an outsider in the Republican Party. Bernie Sanders is an outsider in the Democratic Party. The difference is Bernie Sanders has never run a negative ad in his life. He has never said, to the best of my knowledge, anything bad about any of the Democrats, and he refuses to criticize Hillary Clinton. In fact, he speaks highly of her. He says, I've known her for 25 years. She's a good friend, and she's and she'd make a great president. But here's where I stand, right? And people keep trying to get Bernie to trash her. Donald Trump, on the other hand, well, he just comes right out and says, oh, these other Republicans, they're losers, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's the kind of outsider, you know, I think O'Reilly is right when he says that Donald Trump is doing slash and burn as an outsider against the insiders in a way that could actually hurt the Republican Party. What are your thoughts on all these things that I just laid out?
Well, it's always interesting when you hear, you know, a guy worth $9 billion described as an outsider. But, you know, he's been on the inside and the outside for 30 years. I mean, it was more than 30 years ago when he helped Mayor Koch bring ice skating back to Central Park, which was sort of...
Well, I'd say in New York City, he's an insider.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's absolutely an insider in New York City and right. Arguably in New York state politics. But nationally, he's very much an outsider, in my opinion.
And I think it's going to cut both ways for him. In a lot of ways, he's running sort of the straight talk bully campaign that Chris Christie is unable to launch for whatever reason.
Right. He wants to be the new Teddy Roosevelt.
He's going to hurt because he just says things almost, it seems like he's not thinking them out. You know, it's not like we're not getting really deep theoretical insight.
Well, this is a guy who inherited $500 million from daddy and turned it into entire thing and then turned it into a much larger fortune. He's never really had to think things through.
Tom.
Yeah.
He made his money the old fashioned way.
He inherited
it. Left him 2,000 apartments in New York City.
Right. Exactly.
But I think in another way, though, Donald Trump could help the Republican Party because he is going to pull in people who never follow politics, but they know about this reality star called Donald Trump. And there are people who really are not engaged. They don't read the papers. They're the type of people you talk to them about politics. Their eyes glaze over. They have no interest whatsoever, but they know Donald Trump. And I think what's going to happen is, in a lot of ways, journalism is a real estate business. You only have so much space on the front page of the New York Times. You only have so much time in a cable news broadcast. And so there's going to be Bush. There's going to be Walker. There's going to be Rubio, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz. And then these other candidates are going to get sort of washed out, whether it's fair or not fair, because the Donald is always going to get the space he needs in a broadcast or in a publication or in a website. I mean,
right. If push comes to shove, he'll buy it.
Traffic. Say again?
If push comes to shove, he'll buy it.
Yeah, well, he could.
That's my point. He can buy advertising and newspapers and networks that will force them to recognize him.
Yeah, and please, let's not forget that, you know, many people on the left have no issue when a Bloomberg, launches an anti-gun rights site called Trace, with his money. You know, these guys are wealthy and they can do whatever they want with it. The problem, I think, is that Trump has not decided himself whether he's going to be serious or not because, you know, he had a very long announcement, Tom. That was a very long speech. But if you break it up into little sound bites, some of the stuff he said actually made sense. And I was saying, thank God somebody said that out loud.
Yeah,
he's
the populist.
He's
the outsider.
There's something to be said for pot, but can he work with Congress? He'll work with Congress if he can raise money for people running for re-election.
Right.
I mean, that's really the...
That's how you work. That's how you work with Congress is you kick into their campaign funds. I mean, that's how Boehner maintains his power. He passes money out to members of Congress.
Well, you study Congress, so you work in D.C., so you know Bob Corker, and you know that Bob Corker carries a lot of weight on Capitol Hill. Most Americans have never heard of him. Bob Corker regularly raises tens of millions of dollars for himself and for other people in Congress.
Right.
And so it doesn't really, so it's like Corker can do whatever he wants, and he has a lot of weight. He always gets invited to the White House because he raises a substantial amount of money.
Right.
And I think, you know, if Trump can get people reelected, right? If Trump shows up at a Missouri Senate race, right? Who dominates the headline? I mean, Trump, if he uses his powers for good, Tom, it could be a good thing. I just don't know how serious he is.
Or how rational he is. I view Donald Trump as a very smart narcissist.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
Which is, I think, a dangerous combination.
Well, I mean, you've studied these things more than I have.
He's going to put himself first, in other words, rather than putting the country first.
The problem, though, Tom, is as you've studied these things, is it's these scars and these flaws that drive people to greatness. A normal person doesn't want to even operate on these stages.
Right. What do you think, you know, Jeb Bush has basically come out and said that he, like his brother, I mean, his brother tried to privatize Social Security in the fifth years of his administration. Remember, after the re-election in 2004 and 2005, George W. said, I got my political capital and I'm going to use it now to privatize Social Security. And it didn't quite work out that way, but Jeb has essentially said, yeah, let's privatize Social Security. How is that going to fly with the American people? People love Social Security.
I think a lot of people are surprised to learn how poorly their Social Security funds perform compared to even the simplest index fund. Like, you can just, and it's really a shame, Tom, because it's...
But they're not supposed
capital.
To perform. It's an insurance
it's
policy.
It's capital being pulled out of the economy, and it's just sitting there.
So you're in favor of privatizing Social Security, too. It's not just sitting there. It's actually invested in U.S. government bonds. And in the 70s,
well, there you go.
And it was growing quite rapidly when you had 13% payments on the bonds.
When you buy bonds with Social Security, right?
Right.
If private people are buying bonds, that puts pressure on the federal government to behave and maybe curtail its spending. But if you basically have a hostage buyer called the American people and their Social Security funds, that doesn't put pressure on people to cut spending or at least spend responsibly because you have a hostage. You just take their money whenever you need it.
What does that have to do with anything?
Well, it has to do is Tom.
I mean, the bottom line issue here, Neil, is whether Wall Street should be running Social Security or whether we the people should be running Social Security.
Well,
and I don't trust Jamie Dimon.
People send in their money to Social Security. More people believe in flying saucers than people believe they'll ever make money on Social Security.
Well, that's because Pete Peterson has spent millions and millions and millions of dollars trying to convince people Social Security is going to go away. It's not going to go away.
It resonates with people. Well, maybe Trump will fix it, Tom. That's the point.
There you go. He can fix anything, right, Neil?
Exactly. Or you're fired.
Right. Or you're fired. Hang on just a second, Neil.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil W. McCabe, the political director with Gravis Insights. Gravis, G-R-A-V-I-S, insights.com is his new website. Neil, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Great to be with you, Tom. Be good.
Thanks. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Joseph, watching Free Speech TV in Bellevue, Washington on cable. Hey, Joseph, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I called about a month ago to talk about messaging and calling people suckers.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that conversation?
I do.
People called in.
And you notice I haven't been using that word that much since then.
Well, good, because I've been thinking about it, thought about it long and hard, and we can't call people names because, well, first of all, our hero Bernie doesn't.
Right.
So that's a good indicator. Because if we call people names and we think of them in victim terms and negative terms, it programs us. So when we put on our Bernie T-shirt on Saturday morning and go to the farmer's market, our body language gives us away.
Yeah. Not to mention the Bernie T-shirt, which you can get at BernieSanders.com. Yeah.
I have my Bernie Sanders T-shirt.
Cool.
And I'm expecting my bear with the... I love Brunch with Bernie.
Oh, so you donated to Free Speech TV. Good on you, Joseph.
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, you know, I took your words to heart, and it's been a while since I went off on that rant. I've not yet figured out an alternative word. We've had several conversations about it on the program here, and people have called in with alternatives. In fact, I think you might have provoked that conversation. So thank you. It's nice to hear back from you, and I'm with you. Thanks for the call. Ralph in Knoxville, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Ralph, what's up? Ralph in Knoxville? Okay, let's try Susan in Wooster, Ohio, watching Free Speech on Dish Network. Susan, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Great.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I have a question for you. You're about the same age as I am, and I remember that back in the 80s, the savings and loan debacle that came about, wasn't there a Neil Bush who was a part of that, and he was part of the Keating Seven?
Silverado Savings and Loan.
Yeah,
Neil Bush. He's George W. Bush's brother. He's Jeb's brother. He walked away with $1 million out of that deal. He could have been prosecuted. He wasn't. I think he's also the Bush brother. Marvin was the security guy at 9/11. Neil is also the Bush brother who was busted with a hooker in Hong Kong, and I think he's also the Bush brother who started the for-profit testing company, educational testing company, at just before George W. introduced No Child Left Behind, which moved the for-profit testing industry from being a $300 million a year industry into being a $5 billion a year industry. I'm pretty sure I'm right on all those things. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. This that family, I mean, you know, they're like the Carlyle Group, you know, that family is so corrupt, and I don't know. It's pretty grim. I don't know if he were there. I don't think that Neil was involved with the Keating Seven, though. Charles Keating was he ran an SNL in Arizona, and he was giving money to John McCain, and in fact, it was the Keating Five, wasn't it? Five senators, McCain and four others, who had been taking his money. But in any case, yes, Susan, you are remembering correctly. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you and Chris in Bridgewater, New Jersey. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Professor, how are you today, sir?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true for you.
Oh, yeah. I've got an interesting anecdote for you about what you were talking about before, about all the major CEOs unloading their stock in anticipation of a crash.
Well, I didn't say in anticipation of a crash. I said, what do they know that I don't know? But, yeah, there's a big article in today's Financial Times. The headline, top U.S. bank executives abandon share sale taboo, and it's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was out at a buddy of mine's barbecue, and I happened to be talking to him about the book, actually, Crash of 2016, which I've been reading for the last couple weeks now.
Mm.
And I just happened to be independently talking about it, and this woman who I hadn't met before, who was also at the party, comes up and says, yeah, it's going to be really bad this year or next year. I was like, well, how do you happen to know that? And she said, my boss is really good friends with Jamie Dimon. I did not know this. She apparently works at some big accounting firm in the city. And it's apparently quite, and this is, of course, anecdotal, but it's apparently quite common knowledge among the upper echelon over there that we are headed for something pretty major.
Yeah, and it's going to happen when the Fed starts raising interest rates. Unless there's some other major trigger, you know, like China decides to you know, take on Taiwan, or, you know, the Middle East melts down substantially more, or Ukraine, you know, flares up and NATO and Russia come into collision course. You know, there's a lot of flashpoints that could trigger this thing. But the main thing, and if you're reading Crash of 2016, you know my thinking on this, we never really put our economy back together after the crash of 2008. Or after the major deregulation of 1999 and 2000. And because we haven't put our economy back together in a way that works and is safe, or really it goes back to Reaganomics, the consequence of that is that the next crash is going to be even worse than the last one. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Terrell in Denver. Hey, Terrell, what's up? Terrell? Listening on iHeartRadio? He's on line 10. Okay, I'm going to put him on hold, and we'll see if maybe Danielle can figure this one out. Mike in Chicago. We're trying to figure out if we have a phone problem or if people are just forgetting to listen to their phone and listening to the radio instead. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Good, yeah. I wanted to go back to what you were talking about at the start of the show with the Supreme Court nominations.
Right.
You know, like you, I will back, you know, Bernie all the way through the primary. And then if, of course, if Hillary does pull it out, and you know, of course, I will vote for her. But then, of course, the next step to think about is, you know, the Senate committees, you know, that will control those hearings. And, you know, given their, you know, the Republicans, you know, ability to sit on the
well, the Republicans are very vulnerable in the Senate in this election. There's twice as many Republicans up for re-election, roughly, as there are Democrats. And so it's possible that the Senate could flip back to Democratic control. It's even possible the House could, although that would take a major, major change. And I think a crash would produce that, frankly. I think a crash would produce an FDR moment. But I'm not hoping for one because it'll be painful for all of us if it happens.
Yeah, right.
So,
but yeah, but how, you know, if they were to try and hold things up, I mean, is there a point where the Supreme Court simply can't function?
With regard to what? You mean the Fed can't function?
If they're waiting on nominations, you know, can the Supreme Court keep functioning? You know, is there a certain point where they just have to shut down if they're sitting on nominations?
Oh, if no, there isn't. If two or three people were to resign or die from the Supreme Court, and you couldn't get something through the Senate, the Supreme Court would just be making decisions with a smaller number of people, and they would just wait until it happened.
Then go ahead and do that. Okay.
Yeah.
Which would be a Democratic, probably.
Yeah. Well, it depends on who's president. I mean, it's going to be crazy time. Mike, thanks for the call. Very thoughtful question.
Okay.
Matt in Springfield, Virginia. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi, you know, I was just really enjoyed your take on D.C. culture and wanted to underscore how small this town is. It's really a village.
Yeah.
And there's just a few people in it. And if you recall, when the Clintons got here, they did not ingratiate themselves with local Washington, D.C. status people, and they were considered the Hicks from Arkansas.
Right. They were for the first year or two of the Clinton administration, they were viewed as the outsiders. And then, you know, they surrounded themselves with insiders, you know, the Larry Summers, the Jamie Rubins, all these folks. And now they're very much, I mean, they are the definition of the insiders.
It's true, and it's unfortunate. I'm really kind of hoping for a populist moment myself. But the company town here, and the company is politics.
Yeah.
And everyone seems around here to affect this knowing attitude, like politics is all about the facade of it. We really know what's going on the inside, and I find that very aggravating.
Yeah, yeah. Do you work in politics in D.C.?
I sure do, and I brief staffers every day, and insufferable, and staffer is a redundancy.
Can you? I'm not asking you for, you know, huge disclosures, but we have a little less than a minute left. Can you explain that?
Well, yes, because staffers tend to be young.
By staffers, you're talking about staffers for members of Congress?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yeah, and they all work for a chief of staff who is an overworked guy, but they are the most insufferable because they tend to be in their mid-20s, maybe 29, 30 years old, and they think they've got the keys of the kingdom.
Right, they're insiders.
You're the congressman.
Right. Yeah, they think they are the insiders, and really they're the real insiders. Look at folks like the staffers and go, yeah, they're the useful, you know, I don't want to call them useful idiots, but they're they do the grunt work, right? But they're not really the insiders. They're excellent point, Matt. Thanks for calling and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. 28 minutes past the hour, and thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. 28 minutes past the hour, we'll be back with more of your calls and my thoughts, the news of the day, and I still have not yet gotten to this $68,000 fine for swearing online. This is an amazing story.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And that happened in the United Arab Emirates, but now it's happening in Alexandria, Virginia. Very interesting. Stick around.
I have so got brains.
Well, why don't you use them?
Go!
I haven't got a brain.
Dumbest thing ever.
Because I haven't got a brain.
That's the dumbest thing I ever heard.
Oh, if I only had a brain.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our If I Only Had a Brain. We used to have that as a theme music, but it's copyrighted, I think. Anyway, an Iowa City man kind of blew it. He broke into the Creekside Market, according to KCRG, last Friday night, threw a brick through the front door, causing $1,000 in damage. Police showed up. Found Francisco Munoz about 100 yards from the store. And what was it that made him a suspect? Well, turns out that there was a trail of snacks and lottery tickets from the store to him, and he was covered in nacho cheese, which didn't help, right? So, as Danielle notes, becoming a criminal mastermind is nacho specialty. But wait, there's more! A New Zealand man accused of giving police a fake name was arrested when officers discovered the name belonged to a wanted man. Brilliant, right? The 23-year-old suspect was pulled over Friday when he was arrested when officers determined that the name, you know, he gave a fake name, and it turned out that the fake name was of a guy who was wanted for violating conditions of his bail. So they continued. He was never fingerprinted, so they didn't realize he wasn't the guy he said he was. And they took him to jail as the guy, as the fake name. You know, so now he's looking at charges of giving a fake name as well as the original arrest. It's like, not all that bright. That's why they call them criminals. Craig in Akron, Ohio. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. How you doing today, sir?
Great. What's up?
Well, two things. Wasn't going to bring this one up, but I had a friend of mine that happened to. The police officer came and was giving us a rough time. And unfortunately, the poor guy's name's Tim Smith, and the officer just thought he was lying to him.
Oh, really? Not
yeah.
Good.
But nevertheless,
yeah.
That was in Kent, Ohio.
Yeah.
Anyhow, in Akron, our mayor, who just retired, named Don Pasqualic, he raised our income tax by one half of 1%.
Right.
And for about 5 years, he put that money, banked it away, and then he replaced all of the high schools, all of the junior highs, and all of the elementary schools all throughout the city of Akron.
Wow.
Yeah. And since that's all been taken care of now, he has now, this year, increase the amount of police officers and the amount of fire department employees, too.
This guy must be a Democrat.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
And he was, he's been in government in Akron for 41 years, and he was our mayor for nearly 30.
Wow.
He's just retired. He's just in his early 60s, just a few years older than I am. And I think he'd be a great governor for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ohio could use a good governor. You're stuck with John Kasich. I mean, that's really sad.
We had a really good governor a few years ago.
Yeah.
But then we got this guy.
Well, and Kasich is like, you know, ruining the state just so that he can run for president.
Exactly.
You know, which is really tragic when these right-wingers decide to just go off the rails. Craig, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing that story. That's an amazing story. That's wonderful to hear. Jim in Crescent City, California, listening on KGEO. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Great station, 1480 on the AM dial.
Yep.
I'm 90 miles north of them. Hey, Tom, listen, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. I've worked for 108 radio stations since 1958. I called another talk show, and I said, you know what? Is it Ronald Reagan that broke up the FCC? We used to have only 7 AM, 7 FM, and 7 TV stations to any company a private mom and pop or a corporation.
Right.
We need to go back to that.
Those were called the ownership rules, the FCC ownership rules. And yes, they started disintegrating under the Reagan administration, but they really disintegrated. Reagan expanded it slightly so that a company could own, like, I don't remember the numbers, but it was like 40 or 50 or whatever, and two in a market and stuff like that. But when Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 1996, that was what really made it possible for Clear Channel and Cumulus to end up basically owning virtually all the radio stations in the country, and the same with the TV stations.
Do you know who Bob Pittman is?
Yeah, I do.
He runs Clear Channel.
Yeah, I know.
A friend of mine, Bill Hennis, took over for as program director at WMAQ in Chicago,
yeah.
The NBC flagship station. He asked me if I wanted to go to lunch at McCormick Place. I'll make this really quick, Tom. Anyway, we were sitting there. I wasn't talking. Bill said, don't say anything. I'm talking to my... Bob said to me, he says, what do you think about everything? You haven't said nothing. I said, you know what? Wouldn't it be great if you could take videos of songs and put them on TV? And he came out with MTV.
You gave him the idea. Amazing. But you wanted to talk about Bernie. That's what you called about, right?
Yes, that's what I want to talk about. Bernie Sanders has got to be our next president. I swear to God, he has got everything he talks about is what I want to. But I would really like to see him go and challenge the FCC and get it back to we can have mom-and-pop radio stations. Because let me tell you something.
Bernie has talked about that on this program a number of times, Jim.
Okay. My favorite station, it's a conservative, I'm not conservative, a liberal, KGOE in Eureka. Up here in Crescent City, I started working here in 64. And as a mom and pop, my friend Bill Stamps owned the station. And we had news on there. We have six or seven auto jackings in this town, and it doesn't get covered. We have so much news that's important that doesn't get covered because corporate radio doesn't want to contribute any time to
Well, they lay off local staff. And this is, by the way, not a hit on Cumulus or on Clear Channel. They're just doing what the law allows. It's really a hit on our politicians who said, hey, let's try this experiment with letting our media be, you know, consolidated, essentially. And it's not just radio. It's television. It's newspapers. I mean, look at Gannett and all the newspapers that they own all across the country that aren't branded as Gannett, you know, it's among others. I mean, I'm with you. I think that the ownership rules and Bernie has talked about this on this program. I'm not a spokesman for him. I can't say exactly what his position was, but I know that he thinks that media consolidation has gone beyond a point that is good for a democratic republic. Jim, thanks for the call and thanks for your for listening to KGEO. I think it's KGOE. Keith in Landrum, South Carolina. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First off, I have to say the only wasted vote is the one you don't cast. And
exactly.
If you don't cast a vote, you have no point of talking about politics. Now we come down to, in a general election, if it comes down to Hillary or Bernie, and Hillary wins the nomination, I live in a blood-red state. Hillary has no chance of winning my state. I plan to write in Bernie. But isn't it time to do away with the Electoral College and let the popular vote win the election? It would force the candidates to campaign in all 50 states.
Yeah, well, it would and it wouldn't. And there's actually a fairly strong case that can be made against getting rid of the Electoral College because we have so urbanized the United States. Back 70, 80 years ago, there was a fairly large rural population. Now, if we were to do away with the Electoral College and just go with the popular national vote, the candidates would only have to campaign in, I think, 18 or 22 cities. Basically, there's a relatively small number of urban areas that would be it. You know, if you just get those people to vote, you would have more than half of the United States, and they could pretty much ignore everybody else. Now, that would be good for the Democratic Party because city dwellers tend to vote Democratic. Rural voters tend to vote Republican. But if you take the partisan out of it, you know, in theory, yeah, we should, you know, and George Bush, for example, lost to Al Gore by a 500,000 votes in 2000. And yet still the Supreme Court made him president. So, I don't disagree that it's something that we should consider. On the other hand, I don't think that it's quite the evil that we think it is, or that it is characterized as. It does have some small positive effect. But the founders, you know, when they put this thing together, they were trying to imitate the Iroquois Confederacy, the sachems, the councils of elders. That's what the Electoral College was supposed to be. And that's why electors, people who are elected to the Electoral College, don't actually have to vote for the person who they are committed to, and have changed their votes on a few occasions throughout our history. Keith, thank you for the call. Kevin in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Kevin, what's up? We got a minute to the break.
Okay, let me take you off speaker. Okay, can you hear me?
Yep, perfectly.
Okay, so really quickly, this isn't what I called about, but the word to replace idiot for, shills and idiots.
You mean suckers?
Wealthy.
Yeah.
Is victim.
Victims, yeah. That's a good one.
And the word to replace shills is mercenary. Now, I called about George Lakoff said that if you go issue by issue, there is nobody in the middle.
Right. I agree.
So I was thinking, well, how could you illustrate this? And I said, well, take abortion. Nobody has a position that says, well, abortion is wrong, but if a woman needs an abortion, we should treat it like a traffic ticket.
Right.
She has to pay a $20 fine and take a course in sex education or her health insurance costs go up.
Right.
Nobody's there.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. And that's the point that I was talking about in the first hour, and you're illustrating it well, Kevin. This myth of the swing voter, the centrist voter, there is no such thing. Most independents are actually too left for the Democrats and too right for the Republicans.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which means if you want to get elected, the big goal is to get out your base. If you get out your base, you will win if your base is bigger than the other guy's base. Welcome back. And Tim watching Free Speech TV in Chicago. Hey, Tim, what's up? Tim, you are on the air.
Hello, yes.
Hey, Tim.
Can you hear me?
Just fine. What's up?
Tim O'Brien. Is this Tom Hartman?
It is. You are on the air.
Oh, wonderful. Listen, I'm wondering whatever happened to the Warren Buffett, Alan Grayson plan that you were talking about. Is it you had on your...
You need to turn down your TV, Tim. It's terribly distracting having that delay for you as well as for me.
Yeah, I heard you mention the other day on the 40% tariff that the Republicans brought us with Reagan, and it brought back in my mind your program, the wonderful program that I watched wherein you had the Alan Grayson show with Warren Buffett's plan involving certificates for trade as a tariff,
right?
In sense through the import export bank. Why is there no discussion of that, Tom?
Because the insiders don't want it to happen. Alan Grayson is an outsider.
But Warren Buffett certainly isn't, right?
I think that Warren Buffett is treated as an outsider too in this town. He doesn't spread around enough money, at least anymore. He's an insider in the investment industry. You know, people take him very seriously, but I don't think politically people take him all that seriously. I mean, the Buffett rule, he proposed that. Barack Obama campaigned on it. The Buffett rule being that a billionaire should not pay lower taxes than his secretary. It still hasn't been made into law because, you know, the people with the money have bought basically Congress, and they don't want to pay their secretaries, or they don't want their secretaries to pay lower tax, or they don't want to pay the same tax rate as their secretaries.
Yeah, and he couldn't even make the arguments that through the import export bank, it would straighten out all kinds of matters.
Well, it could. I mean, the import export bank loans money to foreign entities so that they can buy goods manufactured in the United States, and so it's a way of stimulating U.S. exports. And it actually shows a profit. So you could argue that it's a good thing. The principal beneficiary of it, however, beneficiaries are very large corporations. The largest is Boeing.
I thank you for that. It explains that I've sent this letter that I made up wondering why there's no answer to it. Not only did I send it to you, Tom, but I sent one to Warren Buffett, too, but to the President of the United States and to all of the senators, Dirk and everybody, you know, and even the New York Times, and the New York Times wouldn't even give me an answer.
Yeah, I think the simple answer is that we need to do away with this experiment, this 35-year-long experiment with so-called free trade, and go back to the tariff system that we had from the George Washington administration to the Reagan administration that worked so well and made America the richest nation on earth. And we are now the world's largest creditor, or debtor rather than the world's largest creditor. And that's the consequence of having changed those trade policies. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And on the line with us is Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, the true story of how Washington, D.C. works, and an interesting catalog of the crimes, literally crimes, of John Boehner. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true for you.
That's correct. I'm fine.
Okay, so what's up in the world?
Well, you know, this has really become very interesting, the Benghazi hearings, because now, of course, have you reported yet on the soda can? We say pop in Ohio, but the soda can throwing incident of Congressman Issa?
I didn't even know about it.
Oh, okay. Well, then, good. I'll give you some entertainment news. Congressman Issa went into the hearing yesterday where Congressman Trey Gowdy, you know, who obviously Issa was bumped aside for how he mishandled the entire hearings previously that he's looked into, including Benghazi.
Right.
And he crashed the hearing yesterday, walked in and wanted to sit and be, you know, a participant, a part of it, or to sit and listen. And there's a video clip, actually, of Congressman Trey Gowdy escorting him out and then kind of throwing his hands up in the hallway, and Congressman Issa threw his soda can out of anger. So he tried to crash the hearings yesterday when Sidney Blumenthal was there.
Wow. So Issa threw a soda can at Gowdy?
In the hallway, not at Gowdy. He would like to have thrown it at Gowdy, but he threw it out in the hallway. You can see him come out with the soda can, then it's gone. He throws it.
Was it
open? Walks down the hallway. I don't know.
Pop goes spraying all over?
It's not clear, you know, on that part of it.
Amazing.
But
Issa's always seemed to me like a guy who's like kind of lives on the edge. You know, he lived on the edge of criminality early in his life and then on the edge of ethical business through his business career. And now he's kind of on the edge of rational politics.
Oh, we actually kept him off my committee. He tried to get on my committee of House Administration. I personally went to the Speaker's office at the time and just point blank told him he couldn't be part of the committee. He would have disrupted the entire operations of the House, frankly.
Yeah, another.
Gowdy had to throw him out yesterday.
Yeah, another narcissist, another Donald Trump type.
But I wanted to add that in case you hadn't heard it. But it also shows how out of control, seriously, they are. You know, he knew he wasn't supposed to be in the hearing. It was a confidential, private type of hearing, and he crashed it anyway. Now, the interesting thing about the hearing, though, is Tyler Drumheller. We now know that his information on intelligence was given to Sidney Blumenthal and then passed over to Hillary Clinton.
Right.
Now, the best that the committee could come up with, Tom, was to say, look, this was information that was not vetted. It was just sent. Of course it was. Now, if the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, had sent that information and said, oh, look, this is from Sidney Blumenthal, and I believe that's a whole different world. She passed information on to the appropriate channels in the State Department that was given to her that was, you know, either correct or not correct. It wasn't hers to determine. But had she not passed that information, that was she, you know, of course, would have been
drugged through the committee incredibly for withholding information
yeah.
from the State Department. So what I'm trying to say is nothing came of this. But Tyler Drumheller is a fascinating guy because he served in clandestine CIA operations from 2001 to 2005 in the Bush administration. And also, Tom, he's the guy that kept saying that our intelligence network was not telling the truth when it came to Iraq. He was the guy that was, you know, blowing the entire whistle on the Bush administration for Iraq. So he exited in 2005, and I thought that, you know, was a fascinating tidbit.
Yeah.
Of that.
Yeah.
So I expect that to be, frankly, the last fireworks we'll see. It was made very clear. Sidney Blumenthal didn't cut any corners. He said, look, I know why I'm here. You know why I'm here. It's because of politics, you know, the Hillary Clinton election. So I think that the fireworks weren't there that they expected.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is why they're there. I mean, the whole Benghazian, quote, investigation, version 6 or 12 or whatever it is all about trying to, you know, bloody up Hillary Clinton.
So the biggest news of the Benghazi hearing yesterday was not Sidney Blumenthal, but it was Congressman Issa and his soda can and
right.
storming out of the hearing, which is available on tape.
Yeah, it's funny. I just saw a clip of it on MSNBC while you were telling me that story. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Then the other interesting point Secretary of State Kerry made talking about international affairs is the fact of when he said, well, look, we can do something with the Iran sanctions, and we're not necessarily going to be able to do something with the information on Iran, and was it proceeding to go towards a nuclear bomb. Now, the reason I mention this is because he's prepared to ease these sanctions anyway without fully being able to go through the evidence that Iran scientists have been involved in secret work to create a bomb. Now, this is coming from within some of the Senate hawks in particular, the neocons, because they want America, again, before we do anything in negotiations with Iran, to be able to go in there and actually prove that Iranian scientists were working towards a bomb. Well, all we have heard about Iran is it's working towards a bomb. So why should the Obama administration have to actually scour the ground in Iran to find out if that was happening? President Obama has always said he is trying to stop them from acquiring a bomb. So
right.
This is, you're going to see this come forth probably in the next 2 weeks out of the Senate side in particular when it comes to anything that the president wants to do.
Yeah. I think one of the subtexts to this, Bob, I'm sure you and I have had this conversation before, maybe offline, about how President Bonnie Sadr, who of Iran, who was the president in 1980, went to the Ayatollah and said, I just won the election in August of 1980 on releasing the hostages. Let's release the hostages. And Ayatollah Khomeini told him, we've got to deal with the Reagan campaign, and we're going to get spare parts. In fact, they had already started delivering tires through Israel before the election even happened. And I think that's the reason that Republicans are so opposed to normalizing relations with Iran, because that a treasonous act by Reagan will come out.
Sure, and then they took the they traded the guns, and then the cocaine was sold on the streets of Los Angeles.
But that's the missing piece of Iran-Contra, is that it started out even before the election. This is how Reagan stole the election from Jimmy Carter, and that's why they don't want to normalize those relations, in my opinion. Bob Ney, Congressman, thank you.
Thank you.
Great talking with you today. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, this is interesting. Nadella clears out senior staff at Microsoft. I'm looking at the Financial Times homepage. Elop joins tech and marketing executives heading for the exit. What was I telling you about just a few minutes ago? The top banks, banksters, are selling off their shares in their banks. It's like, oh my. Okay, swearing. This is fascinating. And then I'll get back to your calls. This is absolutely fascinating. In the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, you know, one of those little kind of, it's almost a city state, one of those little tiny countries in the Gulf of, Is that the Persian Gulf they're on, or the Gulf of Arabia, or whatever? And anyhow, they're in the Middle East. One of these oil barons. They have passed a law that says that if you swear at somebody online, then you can go to jail or be hit with a large fine. And one guy using the WhatsApp app, and I don't know what that is. I'm guessing it's some sort of a texting app, WhatsApp. I'm not big into texting, so I don't know. But anyhow, swearing at someone, this guy got hit with an $800 fine for swearing at somebody. It went before a judge. It went before the Supreme Court, actually. And they ordered a retrial because they said the $800 fine was too small. So they re-fined him $68,000. These people are serious about enforcing their "you may not swear on the internet" law. Okay, see, they don't have an FCC that says net neutrality, you know, it's not the government's business to monitor what you're doing on the internet. But here's where it gets really interesting. In Arlington, Virginia, this is from the Atlantic City Lab, citylab.com. In Brenton Mock writing about this. In Arlington, Virginia, it used to be that it was a $100 fine for swearing in public. They recently, the Arlington County Board recently voted to increase that $100 fine to $250. Now, what's really interesting about this is it's not that Arlington wants to make sure that Arlington is a fairly safe white suburb, you know, upscale, whatever. And by the way, this is they aren't the only ones who do this. Rockville, Maryland has a similar law. There's probably all over the country. But where these laws came from is back in the day. I've told this story when we moved to Atlanta, and I to this day I've not been able to absolutely verify this, but I've heard it from so many sources. When Louise and I moved to Atlanta, and I joined this men's businessmen's group that we got together every month, and one of the guys in the group was on the Atlanta City Council. Actually, he got elected to the City Council a year or so after we got to know each other. And another one was, you know, there were several lawyers, and there was a couple college professors. It was a fascinating group of guys. In fact, I still, every month, I get their emails about when they're going to get together at what restaurant and send them greetings. We called it the Terminus Club because Terminus was the original name of Atlanta. It was the rail terminus. And back in the 19th century, early 19th century. And what I learned was, you know, there's a Peachtree Street that runs to the middle of Atlanta, and there are like 38 or 37 or 39 Peachtree Streets around Atlanta. And this is the big joke in Atlanta. People say, where do you want to meet? How about on Peachtree Street? Right. How about at the corner of Peachtree and Peachtree? Because, you know, Peachtree Street runs into Peachtree Road, which runs into Peachtree Place, which runs it. And apparently up until the 1960s, there was a law in the books that went back to Reconstruction that said that it was illegal for a person of color to walk, live, or work on Peachtree Street. And so as the city grew, every new white suburb wanted to define itself as a white suburb by running a Peachtree Street right through the middle of it. In other words, it was all about race. Well, it turns out that these anti-swearing laws are excuses, essentially, for police to jump on black people. I mean, you know, black people don't have a corner on swearing, right? I mean, white people swear just as much as black people do, as far as I know. But the cops are not monitoring the white people. They're not jumping on them. They're not looking for an excuse to run them out of town or throw them in jail or hit them with a fine. And like I said, the city just raised the fine to $250. And if you can't afford to pay it, then you go to jail and then you get fines. And, you know, you end up owing thousands, tens of thousands of dollars for swearing. You know, police officer comes up and says something and you say something and then you say, well, damn, you know, or hell, I didn't do that. Oh, you just swore. Okay, $250. Put the cuffs back in the car. And they did an analysis of police data by USA Today, actually. This was last year. And Arlington's arrest rate for African Americans was 202 people arrested. This is for African Americans. 202 out of every 1,000. In just 1 year, 2011 to 2012. 202 out of 1,000. Whereas out of 1,000 white residents, 30 were arrested. And this law is often combined with the drunk and disorderly law. And so most of the white guys who got arrested, white people who got arrested, were arrested for actually being, you know, falling down drunk in public. And these laws, you know, go back to, well, here, there was a PBS series called Slavery by Another Name, and I'm quoting from it. With these laws, there was a huge increase in the number of blacks arrested and convicted and then forced to labor under two systems, convict leasing and peonage. Many black men were picked up for these minor crimes or on trumped-up charges, and when faced with staggering fines and court fees, they were forced to work for a local employer who would pay their fines for them. In southern courtrooms, men of color were ensnared into peonage primarily through two methods. In many cases, defendants were found guilty of real or fabricated crimes and were fined for both the crime and additional court fees. When the men were unable to pay, a local businessman would step forward to pay the fines. The convict would then sign a contract agreeing to work without pay until the debt was paid off. Now, this is what, you know, Michelle Alexander writes about in her book, The New Jim Crow, is that our police system has become the new Jim Crow. So it's not that we're becoming like the United Arab Emirates, where, you know, the thought police are monitoring your chats and the morality police are looking for dirty words. It is white communities figuring out new ways to enforce basically laws to keep black people out, or white power structures in black communities, like we saw in Ferguson, where, you know, the community was more than 70% black, but the entire, you know, the mayor, the entire city council, you know, the entire power structure, the city, the chief of police were all white. And what did they do? They managed to extract, you know, millions of dollars a year from the black community through these kind of things. Michael Brown was executed for his original crime of jaywalking. Remember that? He was jaywalking. He and his friend were walking down the middle of the street. And that cop whose name has escaped me now, Scott somebody, whatever his name was, that cop who ultimately killed Michael Brown originally stopped him for jaywalking. It's still here, right? We're still living in Jim Crow. It's just changed its name. As Joe Madison says, you know, it's not Jim Crow anymore. It's James Crow, ESQ, you know, Esquire. But it's still Jim Crow. I find it astonishing. Meanwhile, in Greece, we're going to have to get into this tomorrow in some more detail. The Bank of Greece is warning about a painful Greek exit from the EU. And fascinating stuff on that. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's Anything Goes Summer, so if there's anything on your mind, want to talk about pigeons, give us a call. We'll be right back. Welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. And Johnny, watching Free Speech TV in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, if I had a choice between being Johnny and Lamarck and being a Warren Buffett outsider, I think I'd go with the Warren Buffett outsider. That'd be a step up for me.
Yeah. Well, he is a billionaire.
And I guarantee you wouldn't have to be raising so much Bernie bears for sale.
Yeah, there you go. So what's up, Johnny?
Billionaire that would be. Anyway, why I called on a related subject, you mentioned earlier the description of some people as criminals. You know, these poor schlubs that go to these convenience stores, they break in and they get themselves a bunch of lottery tickets and they eat Cheetos on the way out and they leave a trail to their drunken stupor around the corner or wherever. Those people are what I call desperate people. Desperate people, the result of a desperate, out-of-whack capitalist economy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is life under Republican rule. And you produce a bunch of ignorant people who don't know else how to cope. I seriously doubt they're liberal, so they've got to be more or less either ignorant or Republican friendly. And I really take pity on them. I wouldn't call them criminal. I just call them unfortunate.
Yeah,
they're the victim.
You know, you make a good point, Johnny. And it's something that it's very easy for America to forget, and I think we consistently do. And that is that crime is more often than not a consequence of poverty, not the other way around. And we treat poor neighborhoods as if they're filled with criminals, when in fact, the extent to which there's crime happening in poor neighborhoods, it's the result of there being poor neighborhoods, not that they're filled with defective people.
And on a related note, cops too often find the low-hanging fruit of law enforcement in poor neighborhoods.
Sure.
Since when the last time have you ever seen a cop go into, let's say, an upscale place like the Woodlands, Texas, or Tanglewild, and arrest white people for smoking pot in their house?
Right, right. Yeah, there's an interesting story on Alternet right now. It was up at the top earlier today. It's probably worked its way down a little bit. But it was about a white guy who had moved from Texas to Berkeley, California, had a medical marijuana card, and so he could legally grow a certain number of plants in his backyard. He got the permission from his landlord to grow the plants. He went to all of his neighbors and said, "You're going to see some pot growing in my backyard. It's legal. Here's the card, and I'm not going to grow more. The maximum number of plants that you can grow by law." And everything was cool, except that the Berkeley police actually have a drug enforcement unit. You know, so much for the end of the war on drugs, right? Who came and, basically busted him. You're supposed to post your permission at your garden, right? And he hadn't. And this guy was a former law student. And so he said to them, no, you can't. You know, they wanted to go in and search his apartment. And he said, no, you can't do that. I'm not going to go into my apartment. I'm not going to let you search it. I know my rights. And they immediately arrested him and searched his apartment. And the gist of the story, he then was let go. But the gist of the story is that he was telling this story to a friend of his coworker who was African American, and the coworker said, "You just got treated like a black guy. Now you know what my life is like, except that you got let go." It's a pretty amazing story. I recommend you check it out, Johnny. You'll find it interesting. It's all alternet.org. Thanks a lot for the call. You are absolutely right. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Summer, and there's a lot going on that we've been talking about today. Donald Trump's entrance into the Republican campaign is, I think, one of the most fascinating things that's going on right now. I would like, if you're a Donald Trump supporter, if you're a Republican listening and a Donald Trump supporter, we already heard from one. Who, went off on, the Democrats are responsible for all these horrible things and, Donald Trump is going to save us all. I'd love to hear from you. And I'm not going to pick a fight with you. I'd just, like to know what your thoughts are on why you would support a cranky, narcissistic billionaire for president. And, it may be that a cranky, narcissistic billionaire will make a good president. FDR in today's dollars probably would have been a billionaire or at least a multimillionaire. Well, he was a multimillionaire back then. I don't think he was so cranky, although who knows? I mean, he was, as governor of New York, he had a reputation for being kind of a hard ass. So I don't know. Anyhow. Drew in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Drew, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to give some perspective from I'm an Afghanistan veteran and I'm fairly young, and I think that the Fox News and a lot of people have kind of hijacked the veteran status in a very clever way to kind of benefit them politically. And, you know, like an example would be, there are a lot of memes that go around on the internet that talk about, you know, George Bush wasn't such a bad president. And if the person who's a veteran, I see this shared by a lot of people who are not veterans.
Right.
And I'm very confused as to, you know, like somehow people I think are speaking on behalf of me,
mm-hmm.
or like Fox News, who combined has about as much military service as my socks.
Right.
They say things that, you know, that's basically like as if to say that all veterans, I think, agree with them. Like the story about the person who came out of a store, a veteran came out of a store and he had a note that was left under his windshield because he had an Afghanistan sticker. It said, "Oh, you must be a killer." And that was a big news on Fox.
And in other words, some nasty liberal who hates veterans said something nasty to him.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, who even knows if that's a true story? And then furthermore,
right.
why is that even a story at all? Why is that on mainstream news? You know, it's
right.
It's like just spreading this around. And I'm like, it's kind of clever because it seems like you're supporting veterans by doing this. But really, you're kind of just the strong arm of the, I guess, Republican Party
right.
and their agenda, more so supporting war, not so much supporting veterans, because I think there's a clear difference between the two.
Well, no, there's the supporting the defense contractors, you know, who also advertise right. on these networks and, you know, hand right. millions of dollars to the networks. But yeah, I think that's very much the case, that they're trying to say that, you know, we're more patriotic. I mean, Dick Cheney, who got four student deferments, and then when his last student deferment ran out, this is during Vietnam, his wife suddenly gets pregnant, and he gets a new father deferment, and then the war ends, you know. I mean, these chicken hawks, George Bush going AWOL for 13 months. If you're AWOL for more than 1 month, you're a deserter. And yet he was never prosecuted for being a deserter. It's incredible. And go ahead.
Bill O'Reilly graduated high school in 1967 or something. You know, Neil Cavuto, these people get on the internet or get on the news and talk about we need to destroy ISIS. And if they have no plan, and they have no clue that it costs human lives.
Right.
It takes mostly human lives. And then secondly, it takes, you know, obviously a lot of money. And then it also creates a lot of enemies. And it's, you know, I'm pretty well informed based on my experiences. I read Ghost Wars. Are you familiar with that book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't read it, but I'm familiar with it, yeah.
Great book. And it's like, you know, if people want to get their information from memes, okay, then I can understand that they're going to vote Republican. But if you read the book, if you read first-hand accounts of what the truth behind foreign policy and what Reagan did to and failed to continue to do, and what Bush Sr. and, you know, we brought that, I mean, a few people, not us, the 1% brought these problems to our doorstep, and the Republicans kind of helped terrorists be successful, because
yeah.
a goal of a terrorist is not to – their ISIS goal is not to come to the United States and own the entire continental United States. Their goal is to say that. And for us to think that that's possible, and for us to live in fear.
Right.
And so,
right. Let me make two, if I can make two quick points, Drew, because we're going to hit a break in just a second. One is the reason that you see those kind of stories on Fox News, you know, the note on under the windshield wiper. Every network or every show has a product that they're selling, essentially, a stock and trade. The stock and trade of my program, I consider to be information, you know, kind of an intellectual show. The stock and trade of Fox News and most right-wing talk radio is outrage. So anything that will make people feel outraged, that's something that they're going to go with. And so, you know, I think that that's the, you know, the principal thing that's going on there.
Right.
So if they can stir up the base and they can get people outraged, and then they can pretend that they're all gung-ho for the veterans. Drew Shano says you're our caller of the day. You get a free copy of any of my books that we have here. If you would like.
Excellent.
Would you like?
Yes.
Okay, great. I'm going to put you on hold. Drew is on line six, Danielle. And Danielle, we'll get your address and we'll send you an autographed book. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with your calls and anything goes summer right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Thank you, Daniel. I first saw this a few weeks ago, and I may have talked about this on the radio. I don't remember. And maybe that's because I've taken Benadryl to get to sleep more than once in my life. But Azernor over at DU has reposted this link out of Cure Joy. I saw it originally in, I think it was Science. But in any case, there has been a number of studies. This newest one is out of the University of Washington. And it turns out that there's a family of drugs that are called anticholinergics. They mess with a brain chemical that is necessary for functioning, acetylcholine. And acetylcholine is made out of choline. And these drugs block the manufacture of choline, or of acetylcholine, by blocking an enzyme called choline acetyltransferase. And the result of that is dementia. That there's a high, now whether this is causation or correlation has been the debate for a long time. Whether, you know, it turns out that people who take these drugs and are getting dementia is a coincidence, or are the drugs causing the dementia? And now, and these drugs are things like Benadryl and Nitol and Sominex and Theraflu and Triaminic Allergy, and those all are the drug diphenhydramine. They're all, you know, the generic version of diphenhydramine, which is also, you know, the side effect is confusion and sleepiness, right? Which is why in a low dose it's Benadryl, in a high dose it's Nitol or Sominex. But also are drugs containing chlorpheniramine, I may be mispronouncing some of these, oxybutynin, which is a brand name Ditropan, Toldurine, Detrol is the used for overactive bladder, and the tricyclic antidepressants. Now, these are the old-fashioned antidepressants that have been largely replaced by the SSRI drugs, by things like Prozac. But these old-fashioned antidepressants are being used for a lot of off-label uses, like, for example, anuresis, you know, the urinating when you don't want to, people who pee when they sneeze, or, you know, they're given to children who are bedwetters. And the main ones are doxepin and amitriptyline. And as they note in this article, acetylcholine is a critical brain chemical involved in the transmission of the nerve impulse and is especially important for proper memory and a cognitive function. For example, Alzheimer's disease is associated with severe reduction in acetylcholine levels due to reduced activity of the enzyme that manufactures acetylcholine, which is choline acetyltransferase. So, just an FYI. You know, there was another study that was done, that was published actually maybe a month before this one came out. Now this one these are over-the-counter drugs. Well, some of them actually are prescription drugs. Amitriptyline is doxepin. These are prescription drugs. But, you know, Benadryl is over-the-counter. But there was another study that came out that implied that the benzodiazepine drugs were doing this. Valium, I can't remember the names of all of these things. Restoril. Say what? Oxy? No, that's a narcotic. The benzodiazepine drugs, they hit the benzo receptors, which are very similar to the alcohol receptors, and they're the old anti-anxiety drugs. And they were thought to be, you know, they got rolled out in the 60s as a big deal. It was, you know, Mother's Little Helper, what was the movie about? The pills in the 60s, the women, all these housewives taking pills. And most of that was Valium. And and these other benzodiazepine drugs. And so there was this study that showed that people who used the benzo drugs also were having higher levels of dementia, and they didn't know if there was correlation or causation. It may well be that the people who are using the benzo drugs are also using, because most of them are sleeping pills. Right? They're either anti-anxiety medications like Valium, or they're sleeping medications like Restorol or Halcyon is another one. And there's a bunch of them. I don't know the names of all of them. But I, you know, I've used them occasionally when I travel. If I travel overseas, I have a prescription for sleeping pills, because you just, you know, you get out of sync and you just, you have to get to sleep. And but the question was, is it correlation or causation? And now it's looking increasingly like it's not actually causation. The benzo drugs are not causing the dementia. The benzo drugs are being used by people who were having trouble sleeping. And those people who were having trouble sleeping were not only using the benzo drugs, but they were also using over-the-counter drugs because, you know, doctors are very reluctant to prescribe benzo drugs for more than a few months at a time because people can get habituated to them. And so they would go back and forth between the benzo drugs and the, Sominex. And it turns out it might be actually these anticholinergic drugs, these over-the-counter ones even, that are associated with dementia. So if you're taking any of those kind of drugs, you might want to have a conversation with your doctor. I'm not offering medical advice. Get that from your doctor. But I've seen, this is now the fifth story, the fifth, you know, significant study that I've seen on this thing. And that's pretty amazing. Donald Trump quotes. Well, actually, let me pick up your calls. We don't have a lot of time left in the show, and there's a lot of people who want to get in here. Michael in Madison Heights, Michigan. Hey, Michael, what's up? Michael, listening on Sirius in Madison Heights, Michigan. Michael's on line 10. We had another caller on line 10. That's the third one we couldn't hear. I think we may have a problem with line 10. I left him on there, Danielle. You can check him out. Andrea in Palm Springs, California. You have another word for suckers? Uh-oh. Maybe this.
Hello?
Yeah, Andrea, you're on the air.
Can you hear me? Yes.
Great.
Yes, I'd like to suggest a more palatable term, perhaps, for the suckers, the non-wealthy Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
My dictionary defines suckers as someone easily fooled who gives in with little resistance and is easily influenced,
right.
Whereas the term dupe is defined as an object of trickery or deceit. And I can't believe average Republicans are naive and generally gullible as a rule in their daily life, but they've been the target of a decades-long sophisticated propaganda machine, and the dupes are the prey of these predators and merely collateral damage
of
the oligarchs.
Right. Dupes is a good word. So we've got the billionaires, we've got the paid shills for the billionaires, and then we've got the people that they've duped.
I think, in fact, they're not only dupes, they are sacrificial lambs in the grand scheme of things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're people who are voting against their own best interests and in the interests of the billionaires.
The average Republican wants to think of themselves as just these gullible ones, you know, with a P.T. Barnum ringmaster that are just corralled in.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. And, what was his name, Michael, I think? Let's not use the word suckers because it sounds like a slur. Dupes is, according to your dictionary, not a slur, but it's a way of saying this is the person who's the victim of a scam, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Brilliant.
Right.
Brilliant. Andrea,
very
thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I'm going to have to start using dupes, and please help me remember. I took some Benadryl last night. No, I'm just kidding. Help me remember. Teresa in Bellevue, Washington, listening to KBCS. Hey, Teresa, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Teresa.
I just want to throw out an idea to your amazing audience, and maybe there's some creative people out there that this could, sort of inspire. But I have an idea for increasing voter participation, because that seems to be really key. If we get more people voting, we can win. So I thought about a cell phone app that could draw from public records, or a smartphone app that could draw from public records that would let you know in your area who voted and who didn't vote. And I thought, that way you could kind of, first of all, people would know that, that information is out there, that everyone kind of, just that sort of subtle social pressure, that if you vote or don't vote, it's going to kind of be known. And it could also be used for, like, kind of friendly competitions, you know, like between maybe neighborhoods or, like, such and such elementary could, you know, have a competition with the other elementary to see who can get the most, you know, highest voter participation and things.
You know, in the, you're right, Teresa. In the last election, and we did a show on this back 3-4 months ago, I think it was, both parties are apparently experimenting with this in the form of direct mail pieces. And there's personalized mail. And so you get a letter that says, Dear Teresa, you know, it's from the Republican. Let's say you're a Republican, it's from the RNC. If you're a Democrat, it's from the DNC. And it says, Dear Teresa, I noticed that, or we noticed that you're a registered voter, but you didn't vote in the last election. We hope to see you in the next election. And it's a way of saying, hey, we're noticing you. It's or something like that. And then they tried amping it up to a public shaming, where I would say, Dear Teresa, thank you so much for voting in the last election. Here's a list of the 10 people who live within a quarter mile of you who did not, who are registered but did not vote. And you might want to have a conversation with them. And I'm expecting that we'll probably see a lot more of that kind of thing, because it looks like it was quite effective in those areas where those kind of letters were used by both parties. Voter turnout actually turned up.
Cool. That would be great. And also, my husband had a thought. He said, well, if you're in a political argument with someone, you could pull up your smartphone app and see, hey, you didn't vote. The end of discussion.
Right. There you go. Brilliant, Teresa. You know, for the app developers out there, go for it. Or maybe, Teresa, you and your husband should. You know, pat the idea quick. Thanks so much for the call, and thanks for listening to KBCS. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more of your calls. And welcome back. Randy in Arroyo Grande, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Randy.
I called to tell you about pigeons. I saw on Bill Maher that at the end of his show he has the new rules, and that ISIS has outlawed pigeons because their genitals are revealed.
Really?
And it shows, yeah, and it shows them like, you know, then they make a mock little photo like where they're covered up in a robe.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also,
a pigeon in a hijab or in a burqa.
Yeah, so they're banned. And
that's funny.
So I noticed that. I think it was
it must be that ISIS knows that the pigeons are robots. I wonder if we're starting to use them instead of drones.
I don't know. I've been hearing you talk about that. I don't quite understand. I've been archiving your show for, I guess, since the end of last year. I have to go back to see when I started archiving. But also I noticed in the November issue of Smithsonian that they said that carrier pigeons, the last one was killed in America by a young boy with his gun in 1901.
Yeah.
And the last carrier pigeon was died in captivity in 1911, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a mass slaughter. I mean, they were used for food. And they used to just, you know, there used to be flocks. I mean, they would darken the skies. There were so many.
Yeah, they were seeing something like that, and I didn't know all that, and yes, and yeah, that's what I heard about the food, and yeah, because it seems like they had plenty of other food, but I don't know.
Yeah, America was poor in 1900. We had just come, we were just coming out of the Gilded Age. We had, you know, the railroad barons, the oil barons, the steel barons, and they were sucking all the money out of the little middle class that there was. The census of 1900 showed that the average annual income in the United States in today's dollars was $10,000. So, you know, America was a very poor country in 1900, other than the top 1%, which might have been like more like the top 3 or 4%. But there was very little middle class. It was mostly the working poor, farmers who were arguably the working poor, most of them. And then you had the banksters. So, you know, shooting pigeons for food makes sense when people are, you know, having a tough time. That's apparently what happened. And in fact, actually, they were a delicacy too. They were served in restaurants and things. And, you know, squab, I guess, is kind of the modern version of that. There's a whole history to this. I saw a documentary on this years ago. I think it was in the History Channel, the history of the carrier pigeon and the extinction of the carrier pigeon. It's amazing stuff. But my pigeons are robot theory is, you know, you've never seen a dead pigeon and you've never seen a baby pigeon. Why is it all we ever see are adult pigeons? It's because they're robots in the planet Xenu. You know, planet Xenu is the place that Scientology says we all came from. And they're sent here to spy on us. Yeah. So every 6 months, the mothership comes down, picks up the pigeon. Because what do you see when you get a gathering of very powerful people? Pigeons, right? They're, you know, like they're all over the place. I mean, you know, wherever people are gathering, there's pigeons. And, you know, so obviously they're robots spying on us. So look out for the pigeons, Randy.
Don't look up.
Yeah, there's that too. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Stephen in Burbank, California. Stephen, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, it has to do with the language. It has to do with why language was invented. Language was invented to communicate, and language also involves the intellect and the emotions. In the human psyche, you either fight or flee. If we choose to fight, we can use what it is in our arsenal. In our arsenal is language. There are figurative words. There are words that George Carlin made mention of, the same words that are banned by the FCC. And what they're trying to do, I guess, is try to keep us from communicating with each other.
Are you talking about my story about how you can get a $250 fine in Arlington, Virginia for swearing?
Exactly. That's it. Exactly. It's punishment. It's like you're a toddler on the playground and you use this bad word as a defense against somebody who is causing you problems.
Would that it was that. But really what it is it's just a cheap excuse to be able to arrest somebody and, you know, claim that they said something that there's, you know, there's no record of. There's no way to prove it. It's he said, she said. Cop always wins, at least over the short term. And then, you know, once they've arrested them, maybe they can find out more on them or they can just extract money from them. But yeah, it is an extraordinarily condescending thing, too, to have the city fathers raise the fine and everything else. You're right, Stephen. Thank you for the call. Carol in Dillon, Montana. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, I was just calling about this thing with Donald Trump running for president.
Right.
You know, his past life makes former President Clinton and JFK look like Sunday school teachers.
You mean his being on his fifth wife or something? I haven't kept
something
track.
Like that, and then four times taken out bankruptcy. They want to run him for president.
Yeah. He really blew through a lot of his daddy's money.
He's going to run himself, but
yeah.
I mean, give the SNN lifetime worth of scandal reporting, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Donald Trump would be hysterical. I think he would be a tragedy for our nation if he was president. And people are trying to draw comparisons between him and Jesse Ventura. Jesse Ventura actually believed in good government when he became governor of Minnesota. He has gotten a little more out there since then, and his stock in trade now is what are generally referred to as conspiracy theories. On some of which I think he's probably spot on, but Donald Trump and he's a thoughtful guy, and I don't think that Donald Trump is a thoughtful guy. I think he's basically a financial predator and a narcissist, and he's no Jesse Ventura. I'll tell you that. I know Jesse Ventura, and Donald Trump, you're no Jesse Ventura. Carol, thank you for the call. Tim in West Branch, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, I have a quick solution for the federal government. King versus Burwell.
Right. This is the Supreme Court case where they might strike down the subsidies for Obamacare.
Right. And the states don't build their own websites anyway. They hire contractors.
Right.
So my suggestion is build a mirror image of healthcare.gov, have the federal government sell that image to each individual state for a dollar, then have that link, if you're from the state that doesn't have their own exchange to go to that mirror image exchange, and then that leaks you back to healthcare.gov.
Yeah.
And it costs only a dollar.
That is actually one of the solutions that members of Congress are exploring. And I've read two stories on that. One was, I'm pretty sure, in the New York Times, that the it's a little more complex than that, that the federal government could take healthcare.gov and just slightly modify, you know, a page to make it MontanaCare.gov, VermontCare.gov, whatever, and then lease that to the states for a small amount of money, but run it for them as if they were a contractor, and therefore satisfy the ruling if the Supreme Court rules that the language in the ACA has to be taken literally rather than by the intent of Congress. So we'll see. Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Tim. Great to hear from you. Lisa in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to go ahead and just get my voice out there because it's been so hard and my voice hasn't been heard. We've been fighting for our rights now for illegal foreclosure. But it don't only affect us with all this fraud that, you know, by no fault of our own as the consumers, it is affecting our daughter. Our daughter just graduated high school. She got accepted into a college of her dreams. She wants to be a pharmacist. She's a bright girl. Now, due to all this illegal foreclosure and all this fraud, it looks like she's going to have to delay her schooling because of the financial aid. And we would have to pay $3,000 a month, which obviously we can't afford because we're fighting for our own consumer rights right here in America.
Right.
And to top it off, our daughter, who turned 18, can't wait to vote. This is very scary to me, and she looked at us while we're trying to explain the situation and said, is Wells Fargo the government? And
right.
She said she's thinking Wells Fargo is the government.
Right. Well, and Wells Fargo, I'm sure, played a role in the bankruptcy bill back in 2000, whenever it was, 2003, 2004, I think it was, that said that student loans can't be discharged in bankruptcy. Which I was just horrified by, and in fact I had Debbie Stabenow on the show, Democrat from Michigan, who was defending the bill at the time, and I think, you know, she thought it was going to turn out well. I don't think it has turned out well, but I essentially debated it with somebody on my own side. I thought that bill was a disaster. Joe Biden was in favor of that bill. It was not a good thing. It has not turned out well. So, and I'm sorry to hear your situation, Lisa. Do you have a lawyer? Are you going to be able to get through it?
That's the sad part, and I want to get that out there. Here in Pennsylvania, we went to see three lawyers, and none of them will represent us because they said through litigation you wouldn't be able to afford us if we go up against Wells Fargo.
Oh, geez. I'm so sorry to hear that. Lisa, thank you for the call. I wish you the very best, you and your daughter and your family. I wish you the very, very best. Thanks so much for being with us today. Don't forget, you know, we've got to do something about this stuff. You know, the student loan debt crisis, the banksters out of control. It is crazy, which means get active, right? Join a movement. Go to pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org, which just sent out a fascinating email today you should check out. And BernieSanders.com, HillaryClinton.com. Join something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.